Okay, Rabbi, so we're on Daf Lamed Amid Beis, and we're about to start a new Mishnah. And we're going to have to put on our thinking caps for this Mishnah. This Sasha, I wanted to give to you, if you get a chance to read this paragraph. To you, underline. Okay. Now, the last mission that we learned was on Chav Ches Amid Aleph, and the Mishnah says that if the chametz is owned by a guy over Pesach, then it's not chametz shavul over Pesach, which means you're allowed to have hanor from that chametz. You're even allowed to eat that chametz because it was owned by a goy. On the other hand, the Mishnah says that if the chametz was owned by Yisrael, then after Pesach, the chametz is osur b'hano. Our Mishnah wants to know, in a certain case of a chov, of a loan, as we'll soon see the details, who owns the chametz? If it's owned by a guy, then it's mutter after Pesach. If it's owned by a Jew, then it's osur after Pesach. It's chametz shavul over Pesach. Now, when I say we talk about a debt, a chov, there's always going to be a borrower and a lender. So if it's okay with the olam, instead of calling it a borrower and a lender, we're going to call it a lov and a malvin. Is that good? Because, I don't know, I find, just because I'm not used to the English translation, so there's a malv and a lov. Now, there's something called a mashkon, which means collateral, and the malve will demand that the lova give him some sort of security, such that if the lova defaults on the loan, then the malve owns that collateral. Now, the truth be told, whoa, Reuven, Shalom Aleichem, how are you? Bruchim Abayim. Long time no see. Now the truth is that even without a mashkon, there is a concept that is very similar to a mashkon, and that's called the shibud. In English, I think they translate it as a lien, L-I-E-N. So what that means is that the malva has recourse in event that the lova doesn't pay up the chov to collect from the possessions of the lova. Now, one of those possessions might be chametz. Now again, in the classic case of chametz, which is a loaf of bread, I mean, it's hard to believe that anyone would offer a loaf of bread as collateral for a loan. Unless it was a very small sum of money. And how long is the loaf of bread going to last? You know, but let's say it's a bottle of whiskey, or maybe it's a full cellar of whiskey, of whiskey bottles that are all chametz. So you have to use your imagination and come up with a case where the chametz is worth enough money that it could be a serious collateral. Now, we have to ask a number of questions here. Those are the questions that our sugya is going to address. Who owns the collateral? Anybody want to give me their intuitive sense? The lova gives a collateral to the malva. That collateral happens to be chametz. Does the malva own that collateral, or does the lova own the collateral? What would be your intuitive?
Lova.
Correct. I would have said the lova as well, because again, the lova is only saying to him that, you know, in event that I can't pay you back the cash, you know, you take the collateral for yourself. But it really belongs to the lova. That's what we would have assumed.
He has restricted rights on it.
Oh, so the question is, how extensive are the rights of the malva if it really belongs to the lova? And the Gemara is actually going to present the following thesis according to at least Abaye. We'll see some Machlokas Abaye v'Rava. that the Malva could actually sell the collateral on the open market, and that sale might be valid. Well, again, I'm just giving you a little taste of the sugya, so you know where we're going with this sugya. Because if we're going to say that the Malva has rights to this object, that he could even sell it, then it means that if, this is good news. Why is it good news? Because if the Lova was a Jew and the Malva was a guy, we're going to have two scenarios, right? But in this scenario, then if the Jew owns chametz, but he gives it over to the guy, or if he doesn't give it over to the guy, he designates it in his cellar and he says to the guy, you can, in event that I default on the loan, you can collect this for your own. If that stipulation at the beginning of the halva already gives the malva rights and ownership rights to that whiskey, that's good news for the Jews. Why? Because then if the lova, the Jew in this case, pays up the chov, then he can use that chametz. He can benefit from the chametz, because who owned the chametz? The guy owned the chametz. And chametz of a pesach is only if it's owned by a Jew, but not if it's owned by a guy. So again, intuitively we would have said that this mashkon belongs to the lova. I mean, it's just a certain right that the malva has, which is almost a theoretical right, you know, that in event so and so, then the malva will be able to. But what we're going to find is that that's not simple at all, and that our intuitive response to this question is not necessarily correct, and that the malva really does have rights, extensive rights to the mashkon, such that it's his, he can sell it. And if that be the case, then the chametz belongs to the guy and not to the Jew. Okay, so now the Mishnah goes through two scenarios. There's a resha and a seifa.
Correct. So can I just ask? So the guy sells it to somebody else, and then the lover repays his loan. Right. Then what happens?
Yeah, that's what we're going to learn in this sugya. That's mamish. The whole sugya is about that. Does the lover have rights to buy it back from the seller? Can he redeem it? Does he have to make a new kinyan on it? All these issues are going to come up in this sugya. Ritz Hashem. So again, getting back to our Mishnah, because we haven't yet read the Mishnah, there's a Resha and the Seifa. The Resha is called Nachri Shehilva Es Yisrael. And the Seifa is called Yisrael Shehilva Es HaNachri. So in other words, there's going to be a difference between the Resha and the Seifa as to who's the Malva and who's the Lova. Is the Jew the Malva? Or is the Jew the Lova? Is the Nachri the Malva, or is the Nachri the Lova? So the first case of the Mishnah, which is called Nachri Shehilva Es Yisrael, it means that the Nachri is the Malva. And the word Hilva is the active verb of extending a loan. So the Nachri Hilva Es Yisrael, but now the Nachri, who's the Malva, and gives a loan to the Jew, he wants collateral. Al Chemtzo. So the Yisrael designates his Chametz as a Mashkon. And he says to the guy the following, if I don't pay you up on such and such a date, which is called the Zman Piron, the date of payment, when the loan is due, the chametz should be yours. But now, he adds one word. Okay, and this is the key word. Now, what I'm about to present to you is the Rambam Shita, and it could very well be that other Rishonim disagree with the Rambam, but right now all I know is the Rambam, so that's all I can teach you, that's all I can tell you. The Rambam adds the word me'achshav. What does that mean? That when the Lova, in this case the Yisrael, says to the Malva, here's the Chometz, and I'm designating it that in event that I default and I can't pay you up when the Zman Pirom comes about, this Chometz should be yours, Me'achshav. Meaning, he, according to the Rambam, he added the word Me'achshav. And what is the significance of that one word, Me'achshav? He's saying to him that in event that I can't pay up the loan, the Chometz, it didn't have to be chametz, but for our purposes it has to be chametz, is yours from now. In other words, the status of this chametz is sort of in limbo. I don't know what to call it, because if the lover pays up the loan, then he gets his chametz back, right? And it was never the malvas. If on the other hand he defaults on the loan, then the chametz belongs to the malvat, in this case the guy. And not only that, but the stipulation was me'achshav. Now this loan took place before Pesach. So if it took place before Pesach and the love added the word me'achshav, then it's very possible, and that's what we're going to see in the Reish of Mishnah, that the chametz belongs to the guy, which, as I said before, is good news. So let's look at the next few words in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Achar HaPesach. So here the Rambam adds the following, and Rashi also seems to indicate this, that if the Yisrael did not pay up the chov, okay, he did not pay up the chov, then we now have what's called the mafreya. Are you familiar with this phrase? Huvar hadavar lemafreya. We now can clarify retroactively that from the moment that the chov was established, at that moment the guy owns the chametz. And if that be the case, mutar b'hano. What does mutar b'hano mean? That you can have benefit from the chametz, because who owned the chametz? The guy owned the chametz. So again, we have a flood of questions to ask here. I'm gonna ask you for your patience till we see the sugya. But the basic principle of the Mishnah, begadol, as we say, is that once we clarify the mafreya, that when the chametz came into the hands of the guy as a collateral, it was already his. Then it becomes, as we saw in the previous Mishnah, chemtso shel nochri she'ovar lav ha'pesach, which is mutar b'hano. Now we get to the sefer. Now in the sefer we switch it around. Yisrael shehilvas hanochri. So who's now divvying out the money? It's the Yisrael. The Yisrael is the malva. The nochri is the lover. Al-chemtso, meaning that the nochri now gives his chametz to the Yisrael as a mashkon. Now, Rabosai, if we're going to be consistent with the Reisha, what's going to be the status of this chametz after Pesach? It's Asur, exactly. And that's what the Mishnah says, following the Reisha, following the leader here of the Reisha, the leader of the Reisha, is Achar HaPesach. If after Pesach it's time for payment, the Nochri doesn't have the money to pay up, is then Huver Adovel Mafreya, from the time of the Alvah, that this chametz belonged to the Israel, and therefore Asur Bano, it becomes Chemtso Shel Yisrael Shavar Lover.
So both cases are dealing with a case where the Lover does not pay up.
That's what I call default. In other words, the Lover defaulted on his loan. Is there a better word than default? No, I don't know. You have the arts girl, so you'll probably come up with a better word than me.
Normally, in a loan situation, the default is that you do repay. But here it's assuming
correct.
That he doesn't repay.
Correct. Because the whole issue of our Mishnah revolves around one question. Is there something called Huver Adovel Mafreya? Meaning, if I give you something, but it's not yours unless X happens, meaning there's a factor here that will determine whether or not the kinyan, the transaction was valid or not valid. Do we have the right to say that if the transaction is validated because that condition, you know, was fulfilled? In this case, the condition is non-repayment, right? Non-repayment. Because I'm giving you a kinyan on the mashkin in event that there's no payment of the loan. Does that kinyan operate, and is it valid l'mafreya? Can it work retroactively, such that it may be after Pesach that we'll find out one way or the other whether he defaults on the loan? But be that as it may, since the mashkon was set up before Pesach, the issue of ownership over that mashkon, in an event that the lover doesn't pay up, depends upon whether we say that the mashkon belonged to the malveh l'mafreya. Although again, the payment date might be months down the line, and the lover, you know, didn't have the money to pay, but now the malva acquires ownership on the mashkon. Does that acquisition operate, or is it valid l'mafreya? And that's going to be the machlokas between Abai v'Rava. And we're going to see that our Mishnah is a clear-cut proof for Abaye, because Abaye accepts the concept of l'mafreya. And Abaye is willing to say that in the event that the lower defaults on the loan, the mashkon belongs to the malve, but when does it belong to the mashkon? As of what moment in time? L'mafreya, from the time of the alva itself.
Do you have to physically move it as well?
Excellent. Where is the chometz located? That's another issue. Itmar. So now we have a machlokas between Abai v'Rava. This machlokas between Abai v'Rava was not, you know, it's a little misleading, because we look here and we see, oh, you know, we're learning Masechta Pesachim, we're learning the sugya of Chometz Shavuot Levavot Pesach, did it belong to the guy, did it belong to the guy? Now the Gemara is quoting a machlokas Abai v'Rava. That's not true. The machlokas Abai v'Rava was in a different context whatsoever. And that has to do with whether the Malvik could have sold the mashkon, and if the lover defaults, and therefore the malva owned the mashkon l'mafreya, and therefore the sale of the mashkon on the part of the malva was a valid sale. That had nothing to do with chametz. If you follow what I'm saying, chametz is only a spin-off. It's an application of this machlokas. What is this machlokas in its original form? So now we have a bayishit. Abai says, "Balchov Abai Omer l'mafreya hu gover." If a person extends a loan, and the lover now designates okay. So one second. Let me leave out the word designates, okay? Because as I told you before, even in the absence of an explicit mashkon, there's something called a shibud. Are we familiar with that word? Shibud, a lien, L-I-E-N, a shibud. Which means that even in the absence of a specific mashkon where I designate one object, there's a general shibud over all my nechassim, if I'm the loaf. So what it means is that all my nechassim are now mishubad to the malva. And the malva could collect from my nechassim, the lover's nechassim, in event that the lover doesn't have the money to pay back. Now, exactly which nechassim he'll collect from, for that you have to learn, you know, major sugyas in the bavos. But whatever it is, the malva collected something, and he collected it based on shibud. Okay.
So chometz is not in the possession of.
Let's go slow, because we're not even ready for chometz yet. We're just talking about shibudim, and then we're going to get to the case of the mashkon, and then we're going to get to the case of the chometz. So again, as I said to you before, the machlokas Abai v'Rava is not about chometz. We're going to see, after we understand the machlokas Abai v'Rava, how this applies to chometz. And then, Steve, we're going to address your question: where is the chometz? Okay, fine. So comes along Abaye and he says, "Balchov l'mafreya hu gover." That if the malve extends a halva to the love, the love is nechasim, his possessions are mishubadim to the malve, and the love says to the malve, basically, that if I don't pay you up, then by a certain date, then you'll collect your chov. He didn't pay up. And now he's collecting his chov. He's collecting his chov from what's called nichsei halove hamashubadim lo. From those nechassim that are meshubad lo. That are meshubad. Now, again, we're not going to go into Bav Metzia here, but basically, shibudim usually works with karka. What it means is that real estate has a lien. It could be that an Eved also has a lien, because an Eved has a status of karka, and that's going to be another sugya, not for us now. But in any event, generally speaking, a shibud is chal on karka. There's a machlokas at the end of Bava Basra, which again, I'm just mentioning it, it's not for us, but whether shibud the doraisa or the rabbanon, where the whole institution of shibud is minat Torah, or the rabbanon instituted a shibud. But whatever it is, there's such a thing called a shibud. Now, the malve comes on the date of payment to the lover, and the lover can't pay up. So the Malva now collects from Meshubadim. Says Abaye, Huvrar Hadover Lemafreya, Lemafreya who gove. It now became clear to us that from the time of the loan, the Malva owned those Nechasim. This is wild. We're not even talking about a Mashkon now. We're just talking about a general Shivud. You know, there's no way that you could predict in advance which, you know, whether or not the Malva will collect from Meshubadim, but even more so, which Meshubadim he's going to collect from. There's just like a general Shivud that spreads out over all the real estate, let's call it the Meshubadim of the Lova. But whatever the Malva actually collects, that was his, according to Abaye, from the time of the Alva. Rava Amar, Mikan Ulahava, who go there. Rava says that we're not going to apply the Lemafreya principle, but from the moment that the Malva collects the Chov from Meshubadim, at that point in time, the Meshubadim are his. In other words, he makes a new kinyan. He acquires ownership on the Nechasim Meshubadim of the Loveh. And from that moment of time that he collects the Meshubadim, it now is his. He had rights until now, which might have, you know, realized themselves, might not, but it was only rights. He doesn't have ownership over the Meshubadim. Now there's a long discussion here about whether this halva that we're talking about is only b'shtar or even a milva bal peh. Let's just make life easier for ourselves for the time being, because I just want to see if I can survive the simple level of pshat in the sugya. Then maybe we'll get into the deeper levels of the sugya. But let's assume there's a shtar. In other words, it's not a loan that was not documented. It was just an oral agreement and he gave him the money. No, it was more than that. There was also a shtar. Now, the significance of a shtar is twofold. And I'm just going to mention in passing that in laws of Choshe Mishpat, of monetary laws, there's always a difference between what's called Birur HaDover and Kiyum HaDover. Bir Adover means you need evidence, and Kiyum Adover means it's an act that has it's a legal transaction, an act that has an impact on ownership. So now we have a shtar. The shtar, which is given by the Lova to the Malva, because the Lova writes the shtar, or he gets two Eden to write the shtar, and then when he gets the money from the Malva, he hands over the shtar to the Malva. That shtar in the hands of the Malva has a twofold function. At least according to Abaye. I'm not sure according to Rava. One function, which is clear both for Abaye and Rava, is called Birur. Birur means that if the Lova comes and he denies the whole story, when the Malva comes to collect his chov, he looks at him, he says, I don't know you. I never took money from you. So then the Malva produces shtar as evidence that the Lova owes him money. What if the Lova says, I paid you up? It's true that I borrowed, but I paid you up. So then we have a principle called Shtara Biyotcha, my boy, why did you leave the Shtar in the hands of the Malva? The very fact that the Malva is holding on to the Shtar, that activates the Shtar and tells me that this loan was not repaid. So the most stupid thing in the world that you could do in the halachic world of finance is to repay a loan without getting back the Shtar. That is suicidal, because if you don't get back the shtar, the Malva has the equivalent of money in his hands, because he's going to collect that chov, and you can't give him any, Benson's not going to buy any story that, oh, you forgot to take back the shtar. It doesn't work like that. Now the shtar is a second function, and this is extremely important according to Abaye. The shtar functions not only as a shtar raya, as a proof and evidence on behalf of the Malva, but it also functions as what's called a shtar kinyan. A shtar kinyan means that there are a number of methods by which you can acquire ownership, a transaction, and own real estate. And one of the ways of acquiring ownership on a real estate is through a shtar. And according to Abaye, let me ask a question and give the answer to the question. The question according to Abai, how can you say l'mafreya who gove, which means that the malva owned the karka from the time of the alva, what kinyan did he make on this karka? There's no such thing as owning karka. The karka belongs to the lova. It belongs to him since sheshis may brachis. So how does the malva acquire ownership over that karka? So therefore, we're going to learn the simple pshat in this Gemara, that this was a milva b'shtar. And once the malva has a shtar in his hands, that shtar is a kinyan. Again, it's a kinyan al tanai, in the sense that we don't know for sure that it is a built-in condition. I mean, the condition is that the lova defaults on his loan. If the lova doesn't pay back the loan, then what does the malva have now? He has a shtar kinyan, not just a shtar raya, but a shtar kinyan. So that's called l'mafreya who gove. So as I told you before, you know, we're just sort of touching on the outer shell of this very long complicated discussion. I don't know if you ever heard of Rav Shimon Shkop, but he writes like tons on this sugya that we're learning now. You heard of Rav Shimon Shkop? Nobody? One person? Two people? Three people? Yeah. My father was 15 when Rav Shimon Shkop gave the Shia and the Yeshiva, so they wouldn't let my father in. His older buddy, his name was Rabbi Silver, he was a Rav later on in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I don't know if you heard of him. So his father was Rabbi Blazer Silver, was world famous. But anyway, so this Rabbi Silver was 1 year older than my father, so they let him into Rav Shimon Shkop's shir. And later, after about 8-9 months, Rav Shimon was called back to Europe. They didn't like that he was teaching at YU, so they called him back to Europe. So then Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik took over the shir. And Rabbi Silver used to tell my father that it was very difficult for them to make the transaction. They got so used to Rav Shimon Shkop, he was a very charismatic personality, that it was very, very hard for them to make the transition. They got so addicted, you know, to Rav Shimon Shkop. So my father didn't suffer from that addiction because they wouldn't let him into Rav Shimon Shkop's class. Anyway. So here's the case. What is the nafkemina? What difference does it make whether you hold like Abaye that balchov lemafreya hu gove, or you hold like Rava mikanu lahavu? So Gemara says the fine. Kol hecha da'agdish love v'zavin love kuli alma lo pligi di'asi malve v'taref. The Gemara says the following. The issue between Abai and Rava is not about the lova's rights to this property. Everybody agrees that the malva has rights to the property. What does that mean? That if the lova went ahead and he sold, that's called zavin, he sold his nechasim, or he was magdish nechasim and he declared that they're hegdesh, meaning they belong to the what's called Bedek HaBayis, is everybody agrees, even Rav agrees, that Osi Malve V'Tarif, that the Malva's rights to these Nechasim predate or preempt the Lova's rights to the Nechasim. The Lova cannot remove the Malva from his rights to collect by simply taking the law into his own hands, so to speak, and selling the property. In other words, from the moment of the halva took place, we'll call it on April 1st. Okay? And I'm not trying to fool you. right? And then, on May 1st, the lova, let's start with the malva. The malva comes to the lova, knocks on his door, and he says, well, I gave you a month, and that's what we stipulated in the contract, and it's pay time. So the lova says, I'm sorry, Mr. Malva, I beg your forgiveness, but I don't have the money to pay you. So the malva says, okay, let me just collect from Mishubadin. Ah, says the lova, I'm sorry. Again, I'm sorry. A second time, I beg your forgiveness. I already sold my Mishubadin. I was magdish it. Now you can't collect it because it belongs to someone else. It belongs to Hegdesh, it belongs to a buyer. Then, in this case, the Malva has a right to collect from the buyer or collect from Hegdesh, and the buyer, Hegdesh, has no right to block the Malva. Why? Because already on April 1st, at the time of the Lova, of the Halvah, the Malva acquired Shibudim rights in the character of the Lova. The Lova does not have the ability to break those rights, to override them, by selling the character. And that even Rav agrees to. Okay? So that's called Asi Malva Vitarif. Those are the last three words on page Lamed Omid Beis. So now we turn to the Aflamed Omid Aleph. The Asi Malva Uparik. See, in the first case it says Asi Malva Vitarif. The word Vitarif means he rips it out of the hands of the buyer. In the case of Hegdesh, you know, you can't rip it out of the hands of the Hegdesh because Hegdesh doesn't have hands. Anywhere where the character is on the face of the earth, that's where Hegdesh owns it. But that's called Asi Malva Uparik. Parik means, Parik is the Aramaic translation of the word pigeon. Pigeon, of course, is to redeem. Now again, how much does the Malva has to, you know, the character might be worth $1,000 or 10,000, whatever it's worth. Does the Malva have to shell out that amount of money to get it out of the hands of Hegdesh? The answer is no. He gives a token amount of money, which we're going to learn now in the Mishnah in Erechin, a token amount of money to Hegdesh. And the reason for this is a takonis chachamim, because the onlooker, the spectator, doesn't understand how Hegdesh all of a sudden became chulin. You know, the malva, when he collects from Hegdesh, he's going to take that character and he's going to use it for any purpose whatsoever. So in order to avoid such a situation, we're going to ask the malva to add a little bit of money here. Now, the Lova is going to have to pay that money too, because keep in mind, the only reason the Malva is putting down money here in order to get the character that's his from Hegdesh is because of this takana that the Chacham were afraid that people say that Hegdesh is Yotze Lechulin below Pidgeon. Disnan, so this is the Mishnah in the end of Masechta Erechin, it says the following, that if the Lova was Magdish the Nechasim, then Mosif Od Dinar Upodes Anachosima Elu. Now, here we have to emphasize the word Mosif. What does it mean, Mosif? Literally translated, he adds. What does it mean, he adds? So we're talking about the Malve, and now the Malve is adding Od Dinar to the Love. Actually, that Dinar is going to be the Kesef Pigeon. And basically, what the Malva is going to declare, and this is just to satisfy the audience here, the spectators, he's going to make a declaration that this dinar is a pigeon to remove the status of Hegdesh from these nechasim, but basically that money is earmarked as a tosefes. Mosif means a tosefes. What does it mean, a tosefes? It's an additional loan money. How are you? And now the loan goes up by an extra dinar. So that the Lova is going to now have to pay whatever amount of money he borrowed, plus a little bit of an extra dinar. Because the Malva is only putting out that dinar in order to get what's rightfully his. In truth, he should be able to collect that karka without shelling out that dinar. But this was a takonis chachamim that required a pigeon in order that the spectator shouldn't mistakenly think that Hegdesh yotze lechulin below pigeon. Like there's a way of getting Hegdesh and removing the status of Hegdesh without a pigeon. So we need a legal formality that looks like pigeon, in order to calm down the onlookers, make sure that they know that Hegdesh is being redeemed over here. But in truth, according to the strict letter of the law, you don't even have to redeem this Hegdesh, because that Hegdesh is not chal. Why isn't it chal? Because the Lover had no rights to be magdish the field, because the field belonged to the malva based on the halacha of what? Of shibudim. Again, keep in mind, it's not that Rava holds that the shibud is a kinyan, because that would be a bayishit of lamafreah ugova. But the shibud is at least a zchus, it's a legal right, which gives a power and authority to the malva to block any sort of sale. The lova does not have the rights to sell his nechasim because they're leaned. And if they're leaned, it means that the malva, in the event that the lova defaults on the chov, is going to collect from the shibudin. So wherever it's sold, or to whoever it's sold, or in this case to Hegdesh, the malva has rights to rip it out, to get it back. Now, there's another point here that I want to make about the Mishnah in Erechin that we just learned. What happened? The lova was magdish his nechasim. Okay? Now, we have to point out that those nechasim could not be more valuable than the chov itself. Let me explain. The chov, I'm going to give you a case which is not the case of the Mishnah, just to illustrate what I want to present to you. Let's say the chov was 100. That's the amount of money that the lova took from the malva as a loan. And let's say the lova went ahead and he was magdish a piece of karka that's worth 200. Now the malva only has a shibud up to the value of what? 100. So now there's this karka, this piece of real estate is like a taros, it's like a mixture. It's worth on the market 200. 100 of that, it really, in a sense, again, I hate to use the word belongs to the malva, because again, I'm not holding like a bay, but it to some extent, the malva has a part ownership of to the tune of 100, right? Because the shibud is on 100. The other 100 belongs to Hegdesh. So let's assume that in order to understand this Mishnah, that the Mishnah says that the malva has a right to give just simli in English, a token, right? He gives him a token. He gives Hegdesh a token amount of money. You know, puts down a dinar. You know, a dinar is not much for a piece of karka. And that's only because the karka is worth less than the halva. If the karka was worth more than halva, then the malva is going to have to give a serious amount of pidyon. Let's say the halva was let's say a 1,000 dinar, and the karka that was sanctified by the lova is worth twice that amount. So then, of course, the malva would, if he wants to be poed to the Hegdesh, we have to figure out if he can be poed to the Hegdesh, but he would have to give a more serious amount of money for the pidyon. Okay, so I have both sides. Both according to Abaye and Rava, the lova is excluded from rights to sell or to be magdish these shibudim. So where is the machlokas between Abaye and Rava? It's on the malva, not on the lova. Ki pligi dizabin dizabin malva vekidesh malva. The malva went ahead and he sold a karka that had a shibud on, that he had a shibud on, you know, said he owns the lien, and it's, you know, it's sometime between April 1st and May 1st, meaning the Shas Piron has not yet arrived, and the malva took the jumped the gun, and he already sold his futures. It's like selling futures, if you're following me. Again, it's a conditional futures, but it's a future that, in event that the lova defaults from the loan, the malva will acquire ownership. Or, shall we say, according to Abaye, has acquired ownership, if you follow my point. Abaye Omar Lemafreahu Gove. Abaye says that if the lova defaults on the loan, then Lemafreya, the malva, owned those properties, or that property. The cave unto Mata Zimne Velopara, if in event that on May 1st the Shasa Piro and the Lova defaults, he doesn't have the money to pay back the Malva. Igloi Milsa Lemafreya, it now becomes clear Lemafreya retroactively, Dimei Kara Birshusei Avikoi, that the The karka belonged to the malve from the moment of the alva, from April 1st. Vishapir agdish vishapir zovin. His sale or his hegdesh was valid. Ravam amikanu lahaba hu gover. Rava says that the malva could only collect and acquire ownership from the time of May 1st, the time when the love defaulted on his loan. Kavon de ilu havale zuzi havimisalikle bezuzi. The very fact that the love has rights to pay up, in other words, there's no absolute kinyan here that the malva acquires ownership on the karka. The love, in fact, has rights to pay back the loan, and that's what he really should be doing. And if he would pay back the loan, the shibud of the malva is gone, is completely mufka. Is therefore shtakak tahashtaka kani. It means that now, only when the lova defaults on the loan after the zman apiron, hashta, now the malva acquires ownership on the karka. Again, it's interesting, because through what kinyan is the malva going to acquire ownership? The lechora, there's only one possibility, and that's the shtar. But the shtar is going to work from the shas piron. So what's written in the shtar? The shtar says, on April 1st, right, we the undersigned testify that on April 1st, this lova took a loan of X amount of money from the malva to be paid on May 1st. That's also written in the shtar. And since that's also written in the shtar, according to Rav at least, that date of Piron, meaning May 1st, that's going to be the date on which the shtar is activated, so to speak. It's validated, and it acquires on behalf of the malva a kinyan. But if the malva sold a piece of karka before that date arrived, he was not the owner of the karka, so claims Rava, and therefore the sale is invalid. Or if the alternatively the malva was makdishit, right? If he gave it to Hegdish. Now the next piece of Gemara is a what I call a little bit of a detour, in a sense that now the Gemara is going to show that it seems that Rava himself, in a different context, took a position that contradicts his original position. So what the Gemara is going to go through now is a shakla v'tarya back and forth to reconcile what seems to be a contradiction within Rava himself, and we're going to reconcile that kind of contradiction. So what I would like to do for today is to skip a piece of Gemara, which we'll do tomorrow, Bli Neder, in order to get back to our Mishnah. Because otherwise I feel like, you know, we haven't accomplished a full circle. I want to go full swing around. So what we're going to look at is the word tnan. Now that word tnan, if you count up from the bottom of the page, it's approximately 9 lines up. Let's see, I'll count it exactly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I guessed it. So if you see, the first word in the line is lazer. Yes? Mm-hmm. Again, I can't help you if you have a Steinsaltz, but you'll find it.
Easy.
No, it's easy.
Big bays in front.
Excellent. So look for the big bays. Bays for braces, right? Okay. That's the old cash. Why did the Torah start with the bays? All right. Tanan. Now, at this point, after the Gemara, you know, works out some of the kinks here, some of the glitches in Rav Shita, we go back to our Mishnah. Tanan, our Mishnah says the following: Nachri shehilva es Yisrael al chemtzo. So the Nachri now is the malve, that's the resha, and he demands a shibud on chametz. In this case, right, it says al chemtzo. So the chametz belongs to the Yisrael, but it was now a shibud. It was now leaned to the guy. And the Nachri, the guy, says to the Jew, he says, if you don't pay me up by May 1st, right, then I'm going to come and I'm going to take the chametz for myself. I'm trying to be, Steve, I'm trying to be sort of ambiguous here. When I say he comes to collect the chametz, I don't know. It could be the chametz is in his possession. I don't know, but he collects the chametz. Zok the Mishnah, Achar Pesach, if at the end of the day the lover defaults on the loan, mutar behano. The chametz belongs to the guy over Pesach, and therefore it's not chametz over lover Pesach. Iyamit bishleim if you're like Abaye, dilamafreya who gover. So that means that after the guy, as the malva, collects his chov from the chametz, his igloi milsilam afreya, we apply the principle of retroactive ownership, and it means that from the time of the alva back on April 1st, I forgot to tell you the Pesach was on April 15th, right? Okay, so back on April 1st when the loan took place, is it the chametz already belonged to whom, Rav Osai? If you hold the mafreya, go back to the malva. Yeah. Who's the malva? The guy is then amtula hachi. In Yiddish, we say defar is vahas. Now I understand mutar bano. Now I understand why there's no isar ano on this chametz. And why is that? Because who owned the chametz? If you hold the mafreya, go back. The guy owned the chametz. El I amrit mikano lahavu gove. If you hold like Rava, that the malva only collects from the time of the piron, May 1st and on, that means during Pesach, who owned the chametz?
Israel
owned the chametz. Is amai mutar bano? Why should the chametz be mutar bano? After all, b'rishus of Yisrael avikai, the chametz was in the rishus of Yisrael during Pesach, meaning the chametz was owned by a Jew. Chametz that's owned by a Jew after Pesach is also
manor. Only by a Jew, not by the Nochri. So there's not a problem with Nochri taking it, is there?
Well, I lost you on that. I'm trying to figure out if the Yisrael's allowed to have hanor from this chametz. The Mishnah says
the Nochri is, it's the Nochri that's taking it.
Right. So let's say if the Jew wants to buy it from the Nochri, or the Nochri invites him for dinner, is he allowed to eat the chametz? So the Mishnah says he's allowed to have hanor from the chametz. That makes sense if the chametz was in the ownership of who? Of the guy over Pesach. But wait a minute. If you're all like Rava, that mikana lahavu gover, then at what point did the Nochri become the proud owner of this chametz? Only on May 1st at the time of the Piron. So how can you call it chametz shal Nochri shavu lepesach? And therefore it's mutter, it should be chametz shal Yisrael, and therefore it should be asur.
Asur for a Jew, but it's not asur for the Nochri to take it. That's not
Chas v'shalom. I mean, the Nochri should be taking this chametz because the Yisrael defaulted on the loan.
Right.
Now we come back to your point, Steve, from before. Kisher hinu etzlo. In other words, where was the chametz located during the period of time between April 1st and May 1st, during this period of time with Alva? Etzlo means in the Beis HaNochri. Now, this is really fascinating. Here's Rav Osai, the difference between what we call the Shibud and what we call a Mashkon. And what I'm about to tell you fits into Rava, like a glove. Rava says the following. Shibud means that the Malva comes to the Lova after the Lova defaults on May 1st, and he says, I am now collecting something from your possessions. That's called a gvias mishubad. Mashkon is something totally different. Mashkon means that from the get-go, from April 1st, at the time of the Alva, when the Malv extended the money to the Lova gave, he handed over a mashkon to the hands of the Malv. Again, that can only be in the case of a talit of movable objects. And that's called a mashkon. Here, the story is totally different. What happens now, says Rav, is that in the case of a mashkon, which is called hirhinu etzlo, the object is given to the malva. The lova has rights to buy back the object, but he's buying it back from the malva. We're going to have whole discussions, what if it went up in price, and who gets the differential, what if it was sheep, and the sheep had wool, or it gave birth to this. Again, there could be long discussions about this, but in principle, what happens is that we have a rule called Balchov Kone Mashkon. So even if in Shibudim, Rava says Mikano Lahabu Gove, but in Mashkon, where the Malva takes over the object from the day, from the moment of the Chov, That's a whole different story. Then the Malva owns the object. And the Gemara now is going to quote a Braisa, which seems to record a Machlokes Tanoim about the exact issue of Abai and Rava. And the Gemara is going to have to analyze whether the Bryce is talking about a case where the Chometz was given over to the Rishus of the Malveh, or it remained in the Rishus of the Loveh. But the final bottom line of this whole sugya is that if the object, in this case the Mashkon of Chometz, was given over to the hands of the Malveh acquires ownership through the principle called Balchov Kone Mashkon. And that's what underlies our Mishnah. Our Mishnah is not entering into the Machlokas between Abai and Rav about whether a Malva is Govel or Mafreya, which means that according to Abai, if the Malva sells property of the Lova, which ultimately he will collect, that sale is valid because according to Abai, Balchov Lamafreya Gove, and therefore when he sold the property, that sale was valid. It was his property to sell. Rava says, no, Balchov, Mikanu Lahaba Hu Gove. No, that's not what our Mishnah is addressing. Our Mishnah is addressing a case of what? Of a mashkon, whether in Shibudim is Balchov is Gilumafreya Gove or not, that's an issue that Abai for Rava can fight out. They'll fight it out. But as far as a mashkon is concerned, the Rava himself would agree that when the Lova gives the mashkon from the moment of the Alva over to the Malva, and the Malva takes possession over that Mashkon, he acquires a kinyan on that Mashkon, and the Lova, if he wants to pay back the loan when he has the money, the funds to do so, he can be poda, so to speak, he can redeem his Mashkon back, but now the Lova has to make a kinyan. Why? Because the Balchov made a kinyan on it. And the Nafkamina for Chametz is going to be that if this Mashkon was Chametz, then if the Malva was a guy, and he received that chometz into his hand, that's called herhinu etzlo, from the time of the alva, that means over Pesach, the malva, the guy, was holding on to the chometz, that's his chometz. And therefore the chometz after Pesach is going to be mutabano. So even if the lova comes at some point down the line, and he pays off the malva, and he gets back his chometz, nevertheless, he's allowed to enjoy the chometz, but only if you assume Balchov Kone Mashkon. That's something that even Rava could agree.
So the Mishnah is dealing the case where there's a Mashkon.
Correct. The Gemara in the Habmina thought that it was just a collection of a Shibud. If it's a collection of a Shibud, then Rava's in deep trouble in our Mishnah, because then it means that for this period of time, Rava doesn't accept Lamafreya. The Mishubadim, including the Chometz that the Malva ultimately collected, belong to the Lova. And if it belongs to the Lova, that's Chometz Shavu Lova Pesach, should be also about no. But the Gemara answers, no. We're not talking about a Shibud, we're talking about a Mashkon. And the Gemara is going to apply the principle of Balchov, Kone, Mashkon.
So the Rava needs the Mashkon, the buyer, he's happy with the Shibud.
Correct. That's what comes out from our sugya. Okay, we have just a few minutes left. What I'd like to do is, again, we're still heavy into the sugya of Abai v'Rava. I mean, that's what we're going to pick up tomorrow. But I would like to go back to what we discussed at the end of Shia yesterday. Now, most of you will all need a review. Let's just leave it at that. So the Gemara comes up with a brand new principle with regard to what's called klei cheres, earthenware. And that's called klei cheres eino yotze bidei dofyo li'olam. You cannot kasher earthenware. Why? Because the blia that's absorbed into the walls of the kli can never be removed in the case of earthenware. The Gemara has a suffix about kunya. Kunya is earthenware that is plated on the inside with a layer of metal. Do we consider the kunya as far as blia a klima teches, which means that it's subject to hag'ola, which means you could be machshir it? Or do we say, no, it's still a kli cheres, and when you cook inside this pot, the blia is going to penetrate through, beyond the layer of metal, into the cheres itself, and then you can never remove it. Now, Tosis points out, he had Dibra Maskel HaTorah, that when the Gemara says HaTorah He'ida, the Torah itself testifies that you could never take the Bliya out of a Kli Cheres, it's based on a pasuk that says Yishaver. There's a parsha in Vayikra that deals with what's called a Kli Chatos. In other words, they cooked the meat of a Karman Chatos in a Kli Cheres. And the Torah says, Imba Kli Cheres Yevushal is Yishaver. That it has to be broken. Why does it have to be broken? Because it has a Bliya of Nosar. And you cannot remove that Bliya. So the Gemara says that Amemar testifies about this kunya that the Bliya definitely permeates or penetrates beyond the metal lining inside the kli into the cheres. And how does he know it? You know, who gave him the Ruach HaKodesh? He says, I can testify because on the outside of the kli there is what's called Zeah. Zeah means a certain element of moisture. How did the moisture get to the outside of the kli? After all, the cooking was inside of the kli. So Amemar says it must be that the blia, meaning the tam that was generated by the cooking inside the pot, penetrated even to the outside of the kli, which is called the cheres pot, and it asses the kli in such a way that you can no longer use the kli, because the Torah says ukli cheres asher tavusha bo yishaver. Then if it's a kli cheres and you cook the chatas in a kli cheres, yishaver, you have to break the kli. So Tosfos asks the following question: V'im Tomar tepukle de chazinin lehu de midaise. Why does the Gemara need a pasuk yishaver when a Amemar says I can testify that there is moisture on the outside of the kli, which means that no matter what you do with the kli, there'll always be a certain tam that's bolu in the kli. The Eishloma Deliola Mairi Kodem Agola, when Amemer says he testified that there was this moisture, that was before they did Agola. It could be that after Agola, they don't find that there's this moisture on the outside of the kli. There's no sweat, so to speak. K'mosha Pirish HaKunches B'Avodizor. Okay. V'im Tomer, this is what I wanted to learn with you. V'alo yotze midei dofyo. Why does the Gemara assume that you can never be machshir a kli that's earthenware? I'll prove to you, says Tosfos, based on a sugya in Zvachim, that there is a way of being machshir a kli cheres, and that's called al yidei kivshonos. Kivshonos are furnaces, right? A kivshon. And the Gemara is going to tell us in Masechta Zvachim that if you have a kli cheres that has an absorption of tam iser in it, like for example the chatos case that became nosar, then lahadrinu l'kivshonos. In other words, the way they manufactured the kelim was they took sand or earth. And they how did they harden it to make it into a utensil? They put it into a hot oven. So the Gemara says that if there's a blia of Iser inside the kli cheres, we will just simply put it back into the oven a second time around, and that's enough to remove all the blia. Fractosus, I don't understand. Vamaik deros b'migdash yishavru. Why does the Torah then say that if you have a kedera and you cooked in the kedera achatos, you have to break it up? Why not just put it back into the kivshon? And the Gemara answers that because there were no kivshonos. Okay, that has to do with Kedushas Yushalayim. There were no Kivshonos in Yushalayim, so there was no possibility of taking these Kalim and putting them back into the Kivshon. Fektosis Hoyesh Kivshonos Sharu. It seems that if there were, you know, there's a logistical, technical answer to this problem, that there were no Kivshonos, but if there would be Kivshonos, then you can put it back into the Kivshon, heat it up, and you would get rid of all the Bliya. So why does our Gemara say, Eni Otsimidei Dofyu Liolom? The Omer Rabbeinu Tam, I'm fast forwarding. The Zelo Choshev Yotze Midei Dofyo. When you take the Kli Cheres and you put it into the hot oven, that's not called removing the Bliya, but rather Kevan Sheisiko Nase Kekli Chodosh. What he's doing is he's recreating the Kli. He's repeating the process of manufacturing the Kli. So when they manufacture, they create the Kli. Nostin oso the Kivshon lehasiko. We heat it up by putting it into the Kivshon. And now what we're going to do is we're going to recreate the Kli. So it means that the physical material of the Kli is identical. He's not changing the material. He doesn't break it up, smash it, you know, and add it to it. It's the same Kli. But he can reproduce the Kli, and it becomes a Kli Chadash. Let's see Rabbi Natam again. He says, Lo Chashiv Yotzimit, David Kemet Sheisiko Nase Ke Kli Chadash. Now, Rabosai, I don't get what's going on over here. If, let's say, you put hot coals inside the Kli Cheres, which is your classic case of Limun, and Yotzimidei Dofyo, you cannot remove the Bliya, no matter how hot the coals are and how long you put it inside this Kli Cheres. But yet, if you take the Kli Cheres and you put it into a Kivshon, then it's mutter. You can do whatever you want with that Kli. Why? What happened to the Bliya inside the Kli? Does anybody identify or what word can I use? Empathize with my problem here. I need some empathy. So Rabosa, I want to say that this Tosus, this Rabbeinu Tam, proves that Heksher Kalim is a Torah's Matir. This is not about the physical chemistry of Bliya. I mean, on a chemical basis, in terms of the material physicality here, you know, the physics of it, I don't believe that there's any difference between putting the Kli into a Kivshon and putting hot coals inside the Kli and burning out what's ever inside the Kli. The answer is, HaTorah He'idah Kli Cheresh Eni Yotzimidei Dofyo Liolam. And again, it's very strange because why does the Gemara need a Torah Heida? You know, I have to learn it from a pasuk. What do I have to learn from a pasuk? If there's Bliya, there's Bliya. You know, cook something, give it to a chef, and ask him if he tastes the taste of the original cooking. You know what I'm saying? Bliya as a mitzias, as a physical material reality, is something that you can investigate, you can evaluate, you can test it in a lab. So what do you need a Torah either? You know, it's very dramatic language. You know, we have to quote a pasuk in Chimish, as the Hungarians would say, right? Chimish, and it says in Chimish that yishaver, that you have to break the Kli. I don't need a pasuk for that. If you can't get the Bli out, you can't get the Bli out. If you can't get the Bli out, so get it out. And secondly, what is Rabbeinu Tam making this distinction in between a Kli Chadash when you put it into the Kivshon and the Alta Kli when you put Gicholim in and you try to do Libun? So what I'm suggesting to you is the following, that this Gemara is built, and it's also Sugyan Zvachim, is built on a predicate that's very revolutionary. That Bliya and Heksher Kalim is a halachic legal status. It's not a reality. It's not a physical thing that you can test in the lab. And therefore, we need HaTorah HaEidah. Meaning, If I burn out the chametz from a kli cheres for a long enough time, I burn out the bliya, I can get rid of the bliya maybe. I don't know. But the Torah Haida. Torah Haida means the Torah established yishomer, that there's no heter on this kli. Comes along Rabbeinu Tam, and he says, well, what does Gemara mean by kivshonos, hadrinal kivshonos? The answer is it becomes a kli chadash. And if it becomes a kli chadash, then there was never a din on this kli. There was no halachic legal status on this kli that was mafkia the kli from heksher, from being matir the kli. So I can use the matir of creating a new kli and say that the old kli is gone, it doesn't exist anymore, hence there's no problem of using the kli because I have a new kli, and this new kli was never subject to any blias isur. And I'll give you an afkimina, and then with that we'll end for today. What would be if you took a kli cheres and you put it back into a kivshon? Would it need tvila and a mikvah? Are you with me at all?
No.
I'm suggesting that if you take Rabbeinu Tam as a kli chadash, it needs tvila. Again, it doesn't need tvila for another reason, because it's earthenware. But I'm just saying, if it wasn't earthenware, for example, if you would apply Rabbeinu Tam's principle to a metal kli, and you take a metal kli and put it into a kivshon, if you found a method of manufacturing metal kelim in a kivshon, it would be a kli chadash. It would need tvila. That's a halachic state of a kli chadash. What do you say?
Made in Israel.
If it was made in Israel, then it doesn't need tefillah. But the Gemara says that just want to finish one sentence because I know people have to run, but so I want to get this under the bell. That the Gemara says that if you use a kli for chametz the whole year round in sonen, it needs hechsher. Why? Where's the bliya in a kli sonen? It was only used for coal. The answer is because it becomes halachically, it takes on the status of a kli chametz. And if it's a kli chametz, because you designate it for use in chametz, then it needs hechsher. Yeah, Usher, you want to say?
I would say, but if you're the one doing putting it in, then you wouldn't have to go. You made
right. That's right. So that's the famous tshuva of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Reusing, Hellman's mayonnaise jars, right? It's made of glass, so the chore needs tefillah. Now, what good Jew doesn't reuse a Hellman's, mayonnaise jar? I mean, we use it for so many different things. We never took it to the mikveh, and it's glass. It was created by Hellman's. I don't know that Hellman's is owned by a Jew. So the answer says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is because when you designate it for use, you're creating a kli.
Yeah.
The original designation was just to hold the mayonnaise so that they can transport the mayonnaise. They can't give you mayonnaise, I gotta give it to you in glass. But now you created the kli and you're a Jew, so therefore it doesn't need to be. So there are three reasons why hadrinal and kibshonos would not generate tefillah. One is because it's earthenware. The second is because you created the kli. And the third is, if you don't accept Rabbeinu Tam, it's the old kli, and it already had a hechsher on it. All right, gentlemen, tomorrow we'll get back to Abaye Varava, the sugya of Baal Chov Lev Afreya Ugo.
Is this where
the
Alkanam?
No, I think we passed it like Rava.
I thought you said the beginning of
Passover. No, I don't think I said that. If I did, I guess. Oh, you know what you're thinking of, Mitch, is Eim Zomim. Here we pass like a bar. And Eim Zomim with my friend.
I heard at the beginning that you had walking in the
center.